Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. If you haven't already done so, please make sure the volume of this podcast is set perfectly to your listening enjoyment. Please take your seat, whether that's on the treadmill, car, sofa, or bed, and buckle in for the last trip. My name is Jamie Beebe, and I'll be your tour guide recreating someone's last days in paradise. On behalf of myself and everyone behind the scenes, please enjoy the Last Trip podcast. And because nobody likes a long flight to get to where they want to be, let's prepare for takeoff. Today's episode is going to feel a little different because this isn't your typical missing persons case. In fact, I can't even tell you with certainty if the woman at the center of today's story is missing at all. There's no police file I can point to. No official record of the last time she was seen. No neatly documented timeline of her final movements. What I do have are fragments, a few scattered sightings, whispers from friends and family, and a trail of half-remembered stories that all lead to the same haunting question. What really happened to Christina Licorice McKechnie? Known to those who loved her as Licky, Christina was a Scottish singer, songwriter, and striking figure in the psychedelic folk scene of the late 1960s. As part of the Incredible String Band, she recorded some of the most celebrated albums and even performed on the legendary stage at Woodstock in 1969. For a time, she was right in the middle of the counterculture movement, her voice as much a part of that era as incense smoke and painted guitars. But after the band dissolved in the mid-70s, Licky's story became harder to follow. The vivid details of her life fade, replaced by rumors and secondhand reports. By the mid-1980s, the trail went cold. No interviews, no public appearances, no obituary, just silence and theories. And that silence has left fans, friends, and fellow musicians to wonder, did she choose to step away from the world? Or did something happen to her? Is she living quietly somewhere, far from the stage lights, her friends, and her family? Or did her story end decades ago, unmarked, with no one there to witness it? What I do know is this. Licorice McKechnie's disappearance matters, because her life seemed to unravel far from the familiar streets of her hometown. She drifted through deserts, highways, and unfamiliar cities. Places where roots were harder to hold on to, and where memories fade quickly once someone is gone. When the trail ends in a landscape that isn't yours, the silence feels heavier. The absence is harder to understand. So today, we're going to retrace her steps. The rise, the vanishing, and the mystery that still surrounds her. The world Licorice McKechnie stepped into during the late 1960s was a world in transition. The music scene was exploding, raw, electric, untamed. Rock wasn't just sound anymore. It was culture, rebellion, identity. The air was thick with incense and revolution, and everywhere you looked, someone was picking up a guitar, scribbling lyrics into a notebook, or heading off to join a caravan of musicians chasing the next big stage. It was the era of Woodstock, August 1969, half a million people flooding into a muddy New York farm, seeking peace, love, and a soundtrack for the new world they believed they were building. Performers like Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, and Jefferson Airplane embodied the energy of the counterculture. Psychedelia wasn't just a genre, it was a lifestyle. The music seemed to shimmer, drenched in mysticism and protest. Echoing the anti-war marches, the civil rights movement, the push for women's liberation. For women in the industry, though, the scene was never as free as it looked from the outside. Women were muses, backup singers, eye candy on the album covers. To take the microphone or a place in the band meant pushing against layers of expectation and skepticism. Musicians like Grace Slick, Joan Baez, and Joni Mitchell carved out space with fierce individuality. But they were still exceptions in a world where men held most of the creative control. For someone like Licorice, ethereal, magnetic, mysterious, it was both an opportunity and a burden. You could be adored for your presence, your look, your voice, but also dismissed, overlooked, or written off as fragile. And touring was a different beast entirely. Forget the sleek buses and catered green rooms of today. The road in the 60s and 70s was long, grueling, and chaotic. Vans crammed with instruments and cigarette smoke. Nights spent in roadside motels or on floors or in borrowed apartments before driving another 300 miles to the next gig. Promoters didn't always pay what they promised, and food was whatever you could grab between sound checks. There was freedom in it, yes. The freedom of living outside of the 9-to-5 world. But also, the constant risk of getting lost in the drugs, the endless parties, and the pressure to keep performing no matter the cost. And then there was Scientology. By the early 1970s, the Church of Scientology had begun weaving itself into the counterculture. To seekers disillusioned with politics or organized religion, it promised clarity, transcendence, a way to harness the mind's hidden powers. For artists already living on the edges of reality, it was tempting. But behind the glossy promises was a system of control, one that demanded time, money, and loyalty. Some musicians dabbled, others were pulled in deeply, only to find themselves consumed. For someone vulnerable, searching, or already teetering on the edge, the promises of Scientology could blur into obsession, and disillusionment could turn into collapse. And by the mid-1970s, the music scene itself began to shift. The utopian dream of Woodstock gave way to something darker, more commercial. The Vietnam War dragged on. The Manson murders cast a shadow over the hippie fantasy. Record labels tightened their grip, demanding marketable hits instead of free-flowing jams. The punk movement emerged, sneering at the psychedelic grandeur of the 60s. Disco was rising, slick and escapist, while many of the icons of the previous decade, Joplin, Hendrix, Morrison, were already dead. For those who had built their identities in the swirling chaos of the late 60s, the change could feel like the floor giving way. Fame, once intoxicating, turned fragile. Bands broke up, money dried out. The counterculture dream had burned bright and fast, and now the world was moving on. This is the world Licorice McKechnie inhabited. A woman in a shifting, male-dominated scene. Caught between the ideals of peace and freedom, the harsh reality of touring life, the seductive promises of fringe religions, and the brutal collapse of a musical dream that once seemed limitless. It was a time when a voice could carry across a festival crowd of thousands, yet a person could still vanish completely into the cracks of America, leaving behind only rumors, records, and an air of mystery. Within that whirlwind of sound, smoke, and shifting ideals, there were individuals who seemed to embody the spirit of the time itself. People who carried the look, the energy, and the mystery of an age defined by freedom and excess. Licorice McKechnie was one of them. She wasn't just another face in the crowd or a fleeting presence on stage. To those who saw her, she was unforgettable, radiant, otherworldly, with a voice and presence that seemed to capture everything the 60s promised. Yet, as much as she belonged to that world, Licorice also stood apart from it. So who was she really? And how did a young woman from Scotland become entangled in the heart of America's most tumultuous musical revolution? And where is she now? Let's dive in. Christina Licorice McKechnie's story begins in Edinburgh, Scotland, in the autumn of 1945. Now, the exact date depends on who you ask. Some sources say October 2nd, others October 13th. But either way, she entered the world at a time when post-war Scotland was reshaping itself. And by the 1960s, she was already pulling away from the traditional life laid out in front of her. There's little known about her childhood. It's as if her story only begins once she steps into the glow of Edinburgh's folk scene, a community that was, in those days, more than just music. It was a way of life. Coffee shops and folk clubs were alive with poetry readings, wandering guitarists, and restless young artists searching for something beyond the ordinary. And Licky was right there in the middle of it, She left home as a teenager with the dream of marrying Bert Jansch, the Scottish folk musician who would later found the band Pentacle. The newspapers even announced their engagement, but the marriage never happened. In 1963, Bert left for Morocco, leaving Licky behind. And with that, the path of her life shifted. She kept writing and reading her poetry at folk clubs in Edinburgh, where she crossed paths with Robin Williamson, a singer, storyteller, and multi-instrumentalist who had become not only her partner, but also her entry point into one of the era's most beloved and unusual bands. According to Robin, she fell into his arms, and soon she was swept into his world. Together, they traveled to Morocco, a place that in the 1960s became almost mythical for Western musicians chasing inspiration and mysticism. Not long after, Licky found herself involved in the recordings of Robin's band, the Incredible String Band. Her first contribution was a set of backing vocals on Painting Box from the 1967 album The 5,000 Spirits or The Layers of the Onion. By 1968, she was no longer a guest. She was a full member of the band. Licky brought her voice, her poetry, her percussion, and her presence. Ethereal, otherworldly, and yet deeply rooted in the counterculture currents of the time. She helped shape the ISB sound during their most influential years. Her voice carried through the albums, The Hangman's Beautiful Daughter, Wee Tam and the Big Huge, and I Looked Up. And then in August 1969, she took the stage with them at the Woodstock Festival, her voice echoing across the fields during one of the most iconic moments in music history. But behind the music, life with the band was shifting. By the early 1970s, the Incredible String Band had become entangled with the Church of Scientology. Like so many artists searching for enlightenment in the era, they were drawn in with the promise of harmony and spiritual connection. Rose Simpson, another member of the group, would later reflect that while Scientology seemed to create closeness between them, it also pulled them away from the music itself. The work became less about creative fire and more about necessity. And for Licky, that spark, that thing that had pulled her into the folk clubs in the first place, it began to dim. By 1972, her relationship with Robin Williamson ended. And with it, her time in the band came to a close. And 2 years later, in 1974, she appeared briefly on stage with a Scientology concert in East Grinstead, performing with musicians like Mike Garson and Woody Woodmansey. And soon after, she left the UK entirely and moved to California. For a time, she kept playing, joining the Silver Moon Band and later marrying musician Brian Lambert, though the marriage ended in divorce a few years later. But as the years passed, Licky slowly withdrew from the stage and from public life altogether. She was known for her almost mystical, bohemian aura. But by the end of the 1970s, that aura was fading into absence. She lived in Los Angeles, later in Sacramento, but gradually lost touch with the world she'd once been so much a part of. By the early 1980s, she had slipped out of contact not only with fans, but also with her old bandmates and family. The woman whose voice had carried through the fields of Woodstock, whose presence had defined a slice of the counterculture dream, was now living quietly in the shadows. Or was she? Because this is when her story begins to blur. So by the late 1970s, Licorice McKechnie had already begun to slip away from the spotlight. Her band was gone. Her marriage had ended. She was living in California, far from the Edinburgh folk clubs where it had all begun. Friends remembered health struggles, whispers of surgery, an injury or illness that may have changed her life forever. But after that, the details fragment. One person swears she was last seen hitchhiking across the Arizona desert. Another says she surfaced in Sacramento in 1990, recovering from surgery. And another said she was homeless, possibly mentally ill. But it's in that silence that the theories begin to multiply. Did Licorice walk away by choice? Tired of the stage? Tired of the movement that defined her youth? Did her health fail her somewhere far from home? Or did something darker happen out there in the desert, where the road stretches wide and it's all too easy for someone to disappear? The possibilities seem endless. So, let's step into the ones with the most traction. Some believe Licorice quietly returned to Scotland, fading back into the gray stone streets of Edinburgh, a city that had once shaped her but no longer recognized her. In that version of events, she didn't vanish so much as she dissolved, living quietly, far from the stage lights and counterculture mythology, perhaps never even realizing that people were still asking about her, still searching for her name in their liner notes and old photos. Others suggest a darker ending, that she may have passed away somewhere along the road, her identity lost to time and bureaucracy. Without her stage name attached, any record of her death would be almost impossible to find. Maybe she was living under an alias. Maybe she chose to disappear into another life entirely. The only thing we know for certain is that since the late 1980s, not a single verified trace of Licorice McKechnie has surfaced. No photographs, no public appearances, no legal record tying her to the world she left behind. Among musicians of the 1960s, she's now one of the most enduring mysteries. A woman who stepped off stage and seemed to vanish into thin air. She's never been declared dead. No official missing persons report has ever been filed. There's no paper trail, no definitive last chapter to her story. Only fragments, rumors, and speculation. With that absence, that hollow space where the facts should be, is what makes her case so haunting. Because in Licorice McKechnie's story, there are no certainties. Only questions. So, what could have happened to her? One of the most persistent and chilling rumors about Licky is that her trail ended in the desert. According to some reports, she was last seen in 1986 hitchhiking across the vast stretches of the Arizona desert. Writer Mark Ellen would later put it in Mojo magazine around the year 2000. Licorice McKechnie, last seen in 1987, thumbing a ride under the blistering sun, the highway stretching endlessly in both directions. In an earlier mention, a 1989 issue of Q magazine quoted a former string band associate who recalled her behaving strangely before setting out on a journey to the desert. And that's an image that sticks in the imagination. The ethereal singer once draped in flowing fabrics on the stage at Woodstock, now, standing at the edge of a lonely desert road, the heat shimmering off the asphalt, the wind lifting her hair as trucks roared past. And you know, the Arizona desert is not a forgiving place. In the summer, temperatures can soar past 110 degrees. A single wrong turn, one car ride in the wrong direction, one moment of disorientation, meeting the wrong person. And you could vanish forever into that landscape of sand, rock, and silence. Those who knew her, people who had spent time with her, who understood her habits, insist that it doesn't add up. They say Licky would never have hitched a ride across a desert alone. Not unless something had changed. Not unless she was no longer herself. Some believe that if she really was out there, it might have been the result of drugs or the disorienting effects of a mental breakdown. Others suggest it could have been her way of shaking free from the world, walking headlong into danger because she had stopped caring about the outcome. The Arizona desert theory is seductive because it offers a picture, a haunting mental snapshot of her last moments. But it's also fragile. There are no photographs, no police reports, no official records tying Licky to that place and time. Just memories and rumors passed through the years, secondhand and uncertain. Still, it remains one of the most repeated explanations for her disappearance. That she walked into the desert, into the heat and the horizon, and never came back. But the desert isn't the only story. Another version of Licky's final chapter places her not under the scorching sun of Arizona, but in the quieter suburbs of Northern California. This theory comes not from rumor or hearsay, but from her family. According to some accounts, Licky's older sister, Frances, reported that in 1990, she received a postcard, one that she was certain had been written by her sister. The message was brief, but it carried enough of Licky's voice, her familiar hand, that Frances never doubted its origin. The postcard placed her in Sacramento, California, and suggested that she was recovering from surgery. Some say it was related to a brain aneurysm, possibly an illness that shadowed her for years. The family, desperate for answers, even hired private investigators to track her down. But the search yielded nothing. No hospital records that could be verified. No addresses that led anywhere. No neighbors who remembered her face. Just a faint, quickly fading trace, like a footprint left too close to the tide. It's a different kind of haunting image than the Arizona desert. Licky, fragile, but alive, recovering in a hospital bed, penning a quick note to let her sister know she hadn't disappeared entirely. And yet, if that postcard was truly her last communication, it also marks the beginning of the most puzzling silence of all. Because after 1990, after that final postcard, there's nothing. No more letters, no photos, no paper trail. If she had been alive and convalescing in Sacramento, she left no official records behind, no lasting imprint on the city she briefly called home. Even the investigators, armed with tools and resources beyond what the family had, were unable to turn up a single concrete fact. Some hold on to this version of events as a glimmer of hope, proof that she was still alive and well into the 1990s. Others see it as an even deeper mystery, that a woman could surface so briefly in a city of 500,000 people and then vanish again without a trace, leaving only a single postcard as her echo. Now, possibly the strangest and most dramatic theory doesn't come from journalists or anonymous acquaintances. It comes from someone who knew her intimately, her ex-husband, Brian Lambert. Brian's story is almost cinematic, beginning not with tragedy, but with destiny. He first laid eyes on Licorice at Woodstock, 1969. Just one face in a sea of 500,000. And yet, hers burned into his mind. Later, flipping through record sleeves, he saw her again, this time staring back at him from an incredible string band album cover. Her beauty struck him, magnetic and dreamlike. He remembered saying out loud, "One day, I'd love to marry her." And a few years later, improbably, that wish came true. By chance, a friend in California handed him her phone number. Brian dialed. They met. And within just 2 days, they decided to marry. For 3.5 years, they lived together as husband and wife, bound by a whirlwind love and Licky's unpredictable spirit. But beneath her sweetness, Brian says there was turbulence. Shadows of a difficult past. He suspected she might have been abused by her father, though she never confirmed it. She had sudden bursts of anger, spells of mystical visions, and a growing intensity that blurred the line between inspiration and delusion. It was Licky who pulled him into Scientology, which at the time promised enlightenment, purpose, and healing. Soon, she was spending 40 hours a week immersed in the tech, pouring her money, time, and fragile faith into the organization. When the band dissolved and finances dried up, she had nowhere else to turn. But Brian said Scientology turned its back on her once her funds were gone. He recalls one harrowing night, returning home to hear muffled sobs. He followed the sound to the bathroom and found Licky curled up under the sink, rocking in the fetal position, trembling and hysterical. She was muttering about having reached OT3, one of Scientology's most secret levels. And Brian panicked and called the church for help. Their response was chilling. They told him they couldn't do anything without money. Later, reluctantly, they agreed to give her a review, but only after Brian signed a waiver. The document said, in blunt terms, that if Licky killed herself, Scientology would bear no responsibility. Now, after this, she seemed to unravel further. She heard voices and drifted into delusions. Brian says she slipped into homelessness, sometimes living in his backyard, other times sleeping in vacant lots around Pasadena and Montrose. Oddly, she seemed to take comfort in it, preferring the raw simplicity of outdoor life. From time to time, she surfaced as a waitress, piecing together a precarious existence. Then, in 1981, as many members were leaving Scientology amid internal upheaval, Brian claims Licky did something dangerous. He believes she stole OT3 documents, determined to save the tech. And she wanted to give them to him, convinced it was her mission. But stealing from Scientology wasn't a small act. Brian insists the church pursued defectors with intimidation and violence. If Licky really had taken their secret teachings, she may have had no choice but to vanish, going underground to escape retaliation. And Brian believes her mind broke under the strain. He describes her as schizophrenic, adrift between delusion and reality, homeless, disappearing into the cracks of California. And yet, even as he tells this bleak tale, he clings to hope. He says he still dreams she's alive somewhere, surviving quietly in the margins, and that one day she'll reach out. It's perhaps the most tragic of all the stories, that a woman once so luminous, so striking that a stranger vowed to marry her on sight, could fade into the shadows not only because of personal demons, but because of a system that consumed her until she had nothing left to give. And then there are the theories that live in the shadows of the internet, whispered by amateur sleuths and true crime devotees who gather in forums, piecing together fragments of lives lost. On Web Sleuths, one user raised a haunting possibility that Licky McKechnie may not have disappeared into myth at all, but instead lies buried under another name as an unidentified Jane Doe. The case they point to is listed on the Doe Network as Case 551-UF-CA. A Jane Doe discovered in Palm Desert, Riverside County, California. The date? February 10, 1997. She had not been dead a single day when she was found, so her features were still recognizable. The details? Unsettlingly ordinary, and yet strangely specific. She was a white woman, estimated between 35 and 55 years old, 5 feet 6 inches tall, about 145 pounds, brown hair streaked with gray, hazel eyes. She wore denim pants, a yellow windbreaker, layered shirts in white and tan, and a tan bra. On her left hand, a simple yellow metal wedding band. Around her neck, a clear amber pendant. She carried oversized bifocal glasses with plastic frames, and on her skin, traces of pricey Clinique makeup, an expensive touch that suggested she still cared for her appearance. But there were oddities. In her pockets, she carried bus passes, some cash, and greeting cards with the addressee and signatures deliberately torn out. Even more haunting was an unfinished love letter, written in a mix of English and Scottish Gaelic, addressed to no one. But was it truly a letter? Or could it have been lyrics, fragments of a song never completed? Now, the woman had extensive dental work, crowns, root canals, the kind of work that doesn't usually align with stories of homelessness or transient lifestyle. While her fingerprints were preserved, no DNA sample was ever entered into the databases. An autopsy later revealed she had died of heart disease and may have been living in the area for a few days before her death. The unidentified woman has never been claimed. Her name, her history, her voice remain silent. But the theory posed online suggests, what if this was Licky? What if, after decades of drifting, she surfaced quietly in the California desert, carrying fragments of her past? Gaelic words, torn cards, expensive makeup, and an amber pendant before her heart gave out. The resemblance in age and description and mystery is enough to keep the question alive. And yet, contradictions remain. Licky's life, by most accounts, had unraveled into instability, while Jane Doe's dental records and careful grooming hint at someone with resources. Could they still be the same person? Or is this just another ghost of possibility? One of the many unidentified women who lie nameless in California's deserts? It's a chilling reminder that the answers might not be in rumors or secret documents at all, but hidden among the unclaimed, waiting for the right name to be spoken. And then there's the simplest theory of all. The one that doesn't involve secret organizations, underground disappearances, or unidentified bodies. Maybe Licorice McKechnie simply stepped away. The 60s music scene was a whirlwind after all. Bright lights, endless touring, late nights in studios, the highs of fame, and the lows of what came after. It chewed people up. And for some, as mercurial and sensitive as Licorice, maybe the only way to survive was to walk away from it all. There are whispers online, tucked away in people search databases and rumor mills, that she may have done exactly that. According to some of these sites, a woman by the name of Christina Lambert, Licky's married name, is listed as living in California, even now. Sacramento comes up again and again. Her date of birth matches. The suggestion that she may have slipped into a quieter existence under her own name, trading the chaos of the stage for the anonymity of suburbia. The image is almost disarming in its simplicity. No mystery cults, no desert wanderings, no tragic ending. Just a woman who wanted to live quietly, far from the spotlight that once defined her. And yet, there's an odd catch. Despite these digital breadcrumbs hinting at her continued life, her musical royalties, well, they remain unclaimed. Decades of earnings from her time with the Incredible String Band remain untouched. If she's truly alive in Sacramento, why wouldn't she collect them? Is it possible she doesn't want to be found? Or could those online listings simply be recycled data, a ghost of her name floating through the digital ether? It leaves us with one of the most haunting possibilities of all. Not that she died tragically or vanished into conspiracy, but that she chose to erase herself, living quietly in the shadows, while the world still wonders what became of her. When you lay them all out side by side, the theories form a kind of fractured mirror, each shard reflecting a different version of Licky's fate. In the end, the truth about Licorice McKechnie may lie in one of these stories, or none of them. What remains is the mystery of a woman who helped define an era, only to slip through history's fingers, leaving us with questions, fragments, and silence. When we look back at Licorice McKechnie's story, it's not just the mystery of her disappearance that lingers. It's the path she walked to get there. Touring the world as a woman in the late 60s and 70s was both electrifying and dangerous. The road was freedom, but it was also filled with shadows. And from her journey, there are lessons worth remembering for anyone who sets out chasing music, movement, or meaning. Now, life on tour in that era was not glamorous. It was long nights in vans, sketchy motels, and endless encounters with strangers who did not always have good intentions. For women, especially, there was an added layer of vulnerability. Traveling in groups, setting boundaries, and trusting your instincts were just as essential as remembering your guitar. And even today, those same rules apply. When you're far from home, keep people close you can trust. And make sure someone always knows where you are. Then there's the lure of belonging. For Licky, that pulled her into Scientology. In the late 70s, movements like that promised answers, structure, and family. But the wrong community can cost you everything. Your time, your money, even your sanity. The warning here is timeless. Be cautious of anyone who asks for blind devotion or demands control over your choices. A healthy community brings you up. It does not tear you down. And of course, there's the road itself. From rumors of Licky hitchhiking across the deserts to vanishing into unfamiliar cities. Her story is a reminder of how fragile safety can be when you're traveling alone. Hitchhiking may have been a rite of passage in the 70s, but it was never safe. Today, the advice is simple. Don't rely on strangers for your transportation. Arrange secure travel. Share your plans with someone you trust. And always keep your essentials, your ID, your money, your phone, close at hand. Licky's story echoes a bigger truth. Freedom is intoxicating, but it doesn't come without risks. Whether you're on the road with a band, exploring a new city, or searching for belonging in unfamiliar places, the choices you make about your safety can shape the rest of your life. And if Licorice McKechnie teaches us anything, it's that even the most vibrant lives can slip into silence if those choices go wrong. Christina Licorice McKechnie's story leaves us standing in the space between memory and myth. A woman who once stood on stage in front of thousands, her voice and presence woven into the soundtrack of an era. And then, almost without a trace, she vanished. Was she lost to the Arizona desert? Did she quietly slip away to Sacramento, nursing her wounds, rebuilding her life under a different name? Could she be one of the many unidentified women buried in case files, waiting for someone to make the connection? Or did she simply decide to walk away from the chaos of the 60s music scene, choosing a quieter existence far from the spotlight? The truth is, we don't know. And maybe that's what keeps her story alive. Because every rumor, every theory, every scrap of testimony keeps her from being forgotten. What we do know is that Licky was more than a rumor. She was a sister, a performer, a woman who left her mark on music history before stepping off the stage and into uncertainty. Stories like hers remind us just how many lives slip through the cracks, and they leave us with questions that haunt long after the music fades. How does someone vanish without a trace? Who is looking for them? And who is left to remember when the world moves on? If you knew Licky, if you saw her after 1987, or if you recognize her in the details of any unidentified case, her story may not be over. Sometimes the answers we're searching for are closer than we think. Until then, her disappearance remains a question mark, part of the long shadow cast by the 60s, by fame, by the dangerous freedom of the open road. And as we close this chapter, we're reminded that behind every mystery is a real life, a real person who deserves to be remembered. And finally, remember to leave a review and rate this podcast 5 stars if you like the show, or hell, even if you don't. But either way, feel free to let me know what you think. Please follow The Last Trip on Instagram at The Last Trip Crime Pod and subscribe on Patreon to support the show. You'll get extra research, videos, photos, and updates, and even learn more about my personal travels. That's patreon.com/The Last Trip Podcast. I'm Jamie Beebe, bringing you your last trip and signing off until the next one. Thanks for listening.